Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way.
To check out the video version of this episode, go to youtube.com/Mormon Stories. To keep these podcasts alive, please consider a financial contribution today at mormonstories.org, and thanks for listening.
I've got a big laundry list of issues.
Okay.
Any other really big things like the Hoffman thing, like the Book of Abraham thing that you guys have been right in the middle of? I'll let the tape roll before, you know, I want you to prioritize and then I'll do the ones that are maybe smaller as follow-ups. What are the most, for you, what are the most damning aspects of Mormonism? Or another way to say that is, for the issues that take people out of the church, what are the top issues? And let's just talk briefly about each
one. Okay, the most popular, if that's the right word, the most often mentioned to me would be the Book of Abraham issue. And I think that was shown in your survey that you did. The Book of Abraham is a major issue to people. And beyond that, it's...
I'll just note that Dan Witherspoon did an interview recently on Mormon Matters podcast. He has three church employees, one CES, two BYU staff, all four agreeing that the Book of Abraham has nothing to do with the papyri. And I'm thinking, wow, 2014, we've come a long way.
Yeah, but what do the facsimiles have to do with the Book of Abraham?
No, they're just like, it's somehow Joseph channeled spirituality. You know, it's scripture, but it's not in any way historical.
Well, that's one of my main problems, and I would say one of the problems with the people leaving that I talk to is that nothing's historical. That it all seems to just go down the drain. Everything comes back to, well, just pray about it, and if you feel good, it's true. Well, that's the same thing I get from the polygamists that come in here. I get it from atheists that they feel good about where they've gone to, and that proves it. Or the Muslim, the Jehovah's Witness.
It's probably the same thing you and Gerald say about Christianity.
Well, I think that the argument for Christianity is different than the argument for Mormonism. To me, it's a different category. It's like comparing apples and oranges. With Mormonism, you have everything invented by one guy covering centuries. And just one guy. We have nothing to back up anything he says other than his credibility. He makes up this whole Book of Abraham stuff, scriptures. He's making up scriptures right and left. Here we have this whole civilization in the Book of Mormon that evidently has no historical base at all. The Mormons can't come up with anything. I mean, Nahum in Yemen is hardly sufficient to prove the Book of Mormon.
Hey, the apologists really like that.
Well,
why doesn't that convince you?
Because it's just a tribal name. It has nothing to do with the Book of Mormon. They're just grasping at straws. So it doesn't support anything.
You're saying it's a coincidence.
Yeah. So I see one man inventing this whole religion, all these scriptures. I see someone that I would consider a con man inventing a religion. When you look at Joseph Smith's involvement in magic and money digging and the stone in the hat, which I think is clearly a deception, and I think Dan Vogel argues this in his book on Joseph Smith, that there's deliberateness in the deception of the money digging with the stone in the hat, that they never find a treasure. What anyone talks about finding are minor little lost objects. But that's the come on to get you to believe him for the bigger thing. So he's at your house, he palms a pocket watch or something off your dresser, and you go through the neighborhood, so-and-so lost his watch or whatever, and Joseph comes to you and says, you know, I can find that watch. And, you know, so I think he was always telling stories on when he'd been able to plant something somewhere for him to find, because the testimonies of finding things are household items, are minor things. Like Stoll, that testifies in his behalf at the 1826 trial, Stoll says, Joseph told us if we dug down, we'd find a feather. And then we went down further and we'd find the treasure. And of course, when we found the feather, but when we got down the treasure, we hit that hard place. And then we couldn't, the enchantment was too strong. We couldn't get it. It slipped away. We couldn't get the treasure. That to me is a con man. Joseph has set up a scenario, told them they're going to find a feather, and they're going to get this hard place, and they won't be able to get the treasure. So he's building in a reason why it's going to fail. Because he's got, you broke the enchantment. So you go out at midnight, draw a magic circle, get some poor farmer to give you his black sheep, slit its throat and walk it around the circle and do all this magic hocus pocus. And then somebody sneezes or whatever happens. Someone supposedly does something that breaks the spell. And then Joseph's off the hook. Well, that's why it slipped away.
And there are records testifying to these things.
There's people that were involved in all that that tell the stories. Now, the Mormons want to discount that. Oh, well, these are all people that turned on Joseph or made up stories about him, the neighbors that didn't like him or whatever. It's clear. Everyone, Joseph admits he was involved in money digging with Stoll. He just wants to make it that he was the one pushing the shovel. And yet Martin Harris himself says the reason Stoll and Lucy Smith, they both say the reason Stoll hired Joseph was because of his gift of looking at the stone to discern where the treasure was. Now, I'm sure he pushed a shovel as well, but he came up across the state of New York to hire Joseph because he heard he had this gift. And how does he know he has this gift? Oh, well, when he got up to Stoll's brother's place, Joseph described his outhouse. And then he knew that there's no way Joseph would have ever seen his outhouse, so how could he have described it? And I'm thinking, because your brother probably told some stupid story about the outhouse to everybody. Maybe his kid fell in or whatever, you know. And I mean, what a silly thing to describe somebody's outhouse, you know. So it sounds to me like the brother that lived by the Smiths told some story about his brother's outhouse. And so when Stoll comes, Joseph, oh, yes, I can see your outhouse now, you know. And so Stoll believes him. So I see a deliberate con. Now, he may have soothed his conscience by making a religious aspect as well. And it's not like there aren't plenty of religious frauds out there that can invent stories and claim God's working with them. I mean, you got Jim Baker, for instance, the years back, but televangelist that was living a double life and having call girls the hour before he went on his TV marathons and everything. So someone can speak religiously and still be lying and doing a double life. Everyone wants to say, but the Book of Mormon has all the spirituality and his letters have the spirituality. So did Jim Baker's. And the guy went to prison. So Joseph, I see, is making it all up.
Okay, so we have problems with the first vision. Joseph Smith's folk magic, treasure digging, con kind of stuff. We have Book of Mormon problems, Book of Abraham problems.
Then
what else? Changing the commandments between Book
changing
of Commandments
the and revelations. And yes, well, to me, were a major problem. And then next, I would say polygamy. Well, more defined than that, polyandry, which I think is kind of curious that people find polyandry more offensive than marrying 14-year-old girls, but I think people intuitively know that there's something wrong with the idea of going to a guy that has a wife and essentially pulling rank on him, that he should give his wife to Joseph Smith, and this will guarantee his eternal life or whatever, or telling the woman this will guarantee her exaltation. I don't think all the husbands knew about it, but some did, and obviously some agreed to the whole situation. And I find that this, when people find out about this, there's no way to reconcile it with Section 132, because it doesn't allow for married women. It says if a man have 10 virgins, not if he has 10 married women. So the polyandry out of the whole polygamy issue seems to be the biggest sticking point to people. They can't reconcile that. I personally think the teenage girls are more outlandish because the adult woman had the ability to make a choice, even although I think she was religiously coerced. But a teenage girl who's in a Mormon home where she's been trained to revere this guy as God's spokesman, and he comes and tells her that God has told him to do this. And then when you add the element where he says, an angel appeared with a drawn sword and said he would kill me if I don't go into polygamy. And to put that kind of a guilt trip on a 14-year-old girl or a 16-year-old, that you're going to be responsible for the prophet's death if you don't concede to this. Or tell them, this will secure your parents' eternal life. Are you going to deny your parents' eternal life? So I find the teenage girls extremely troubling that a religious leader would use his position of authority to coerce these girls to submit to this. And I do believe they were sexual unions.
In spite of
Brian Hales. Well, I think I heard him say on one interview that something to the effect that, we can only show that 9 marriages were consummated. And I'm saying, well, how many do you need? If he consummated 9 of them, why should I think he did not 40 of them? You know, it's anyways.
All right. Other big issues.
Mount Meadow Massacre would be another big one.
Why isn't that just people scared and make a mistake on a local level?
Well, why would these Mormons feel that it would be the right thing to do? These are the religious leaders. This is the stake president. This is the bishops. This is the high council, all meeting together to decide to go out and kill all these people. Why? What kind of a system would make you think that that would be okay with God? That you're going to go kill 120 men, women, and children?
What's the answer?
That they were in a cult. I think Brigham intended the massacre to happen. I don't think he intended it to happen the way it happened. I don't think he intended there to be 2 attacks. I think he thought that, they could get the Indians to help and they could go in quick, in, out, and they could blame it on the Indians. And it didn't work out that way. And they ended up with this mess. And so I think that's when you get this writer coming up to Salt Lake. They botched the job. They didn't get it done right. And now they're stuck with this problem. The first go around, we didn't get it done. So now what do we do? And so I think Brigham set up a scenario that he knew the massacre would happen. And I think he thought it would be done quickly and easily and not left the mess it did. So the second attack in that sense, I think, was their solution of how to resolve the whole thing. But then Brigham becomes complicit in the whole thing because he covers it up for years. They have to have 2 trials on John D. Lee because the word's gone out on the first one, nobody tell anything. And suddenly everyone gets a memory when the government says, no, someone's hanging for this. Oh, yeah, I remember. It was all John D. Lee's idea. Now, obviously, John didn't get invited to the meeting. But at some meeting, somebody was discussing, somebody's going down for this. So here's the list. Who do we think is the best candidate? Okay, well, John went out with the flag of truce out to the group, and he was kind of involved in the whole thing. So we could just put it all to him. Oh, that's a good plan. So that's what they did. They turned on it, and John D. Lee says he was the scapegoat. And no more guilty than any of the other men that were there. Now, I don't know if that's true. I don't know whether to believe him when he says he didn't kill anyone. I find that a little hard to believe. He says his gun jammed or something.
That's like I didn't inhale.
yeah, right. There's just some things you think, well, really?
How does it feel to know that the Brigham Young's blood runs through your veins? I mean, this is your great-great-grandpa. Is that true?
Yeah, yeah. Yes, all my uncles look just like him. I think it's a good man gone amok. He started out as a good Methodist. and got caught up in a cult. And it brought out all the worst of him. He became a dictator, a false prophet, a philanderer. I don't think my great-great-grandma was happy with polygamy. They come out here to Utah. She doesn't live at the Beehive House. She's not up there with all those women. She's got her own house down the street. And I'm sure it broke her heart when all that. If you see pictures of Mary Ann Angel, she's a round-faced, simple-looking woman that by all accounts was a very loving mother, took in Brigham's two orphaned or motherless kids, raised them, and then had her own bunch of kids by him. And for all accounts, she was evidently a good mother. But she was no competition to Brigham being able to go and woo beautiful young women. You look at Annalisa Webb that ended up divorcing him. She was a beautiful woman. So Mary Ann Angel had no candle to hold to Brigham's ability to get younger, attractive women. Anyways, I think it's very sad that a very good second marriage for him, because his first wife had died, was evidently a woman that was very faithful and a good mother, and that he ruined her life by getting her all in, well, she was already involved in Mormonism, but taking her deeper into it and making her submit to polygamy.
Are you ashamed or embarrassed to be a descendant?
No. It's too far gone. It's too far past.
Temple ceremony.
It used to be, before they changed it in 90, it was a real problem to people. I used to talk to people a lot that would come in, you know, what is this, slit in the throats? You know, what have I got myself into? And you read stories of people that had gone through the ceremony, even if they don't come out until after 1990, they very often say that when they first went through the temple ritual, it was very disturbing for them. In fact, if you listen to the Hans Mattson stuff and you get, who is it? Jensen?
Marlon Jensen, Richard Turley.
Jensen, I think, that tells about his daughter having such a problem with the temple ritual because she went before 90, and her crying in the celestial room, asking her dad, what is this? What have I gone through? People that went through before 90 were deeply disturbed about this. Now, they make the change in 90, and so we move up till today, and most people don't know it ever happened or it was ever there and probably say I was a liar for bringing it up. But people that went through the transition are troubled by the fact there was a transition. They didn't like the earlier ceremony, but how are you going to keep saying it's from God if you guys get to rewrite it to appeal to modern sensibilities? If it was important to have it in there in the first place, for instance, the embrace on the 5 points of fellowship, which were directly taken from Masonry, that was in the ceremony until 1990. If that was important, and it used to be the highlight of the ceremony, you came to the veil, embraced God on the 5 points of fellowship, and then drawn through to go to the celestial kingdom. They take that out. What is that saying? That, I mean, they're so fanatic about how you're going to do the baptism. You got to hold their hands just a certain way, and you got to say exactly the right formula to baptize them.
Or if you miss a word on the sacrament, you got to say it over.
Oh, my word. I have sat in sacrament meetings where some poor 16-year-old kid has had to say that 5 times. And by then, we're all just sweating with the kid. Please say it right, you know. And yet with the temple ceremony, major elements that they can remove. So how is that from God? And so that disturbs people.
Were you one of the first to make the connections to the Masons, or were those connections made way before you?
Well, before us, you had the Masons, what was his name, Goodwin? A Masonic guy that did a thing on Mormons and the Masons, and then was it Ivins or somebody that wrote a rebuttal back and trying to smooth it all out. So the Masonic, and Brody mentions the Masonic connection. So there were others that had talked about it before us. The temple ceremony had printed before us, but it had been some years. It was 1931 when a minister named Padden, I think it was, did a printing of the temple ritual. But no one had done it for a long time since. So we were a little concerned when we did it. But it's a major, yes, that is a major issue to people. And people that have been talking to Christians, the Christians are talking to them all the time about the temple was done away with Christ. That was the end of that. There's no Melchizedek priesthood. The Mormons are bringing Old Testament into the New Testament that shouldn't be there. We don't need any of these things. The temple veil was rent in half, and that was the end of the priesthood, the end of sacrifices. Book of Hebrews goes through all of that. And so people that are exposed to many Christian friends that talk challenge them, they're often challenged on the unbiblical nature of the temple ritual, the priesthood concept, and those areas.
A lot of people like to give Dialogue sort of credit for the 1973 article talking about Elijah Abel and how Joseph Smith gave blacks the priesthood before Brigham Young took it away.
Yeah.
It sounds like you were talking about that a little bit before Dialogue.
We were doing that in the 60s. I had gone up, a friend of ours had done research on the Abel family. We knew about Elijah Abel. We didn't know what happened to him, whether he got to Utah and what happened to his family afterwards. A friend of ours went up and was checking, I don't know what all he was using to check, but tried to run down his family and see what was going on there. And he came back and told us that it looked like Elijah Abel's son and grandson up in Ogden had been ordained to the priesthood. And then somehow we found the obituary for either the son or the grandson that talked about him being an elder or something. So anyways, I went up to the genealogical library to see if I could find the ordination records for the grandson or the son. Which was it? It would have been the son. Enoch, I think his name was. And I was able to get the roll for the ward or whatever, and there was his photo of his certificate to the priesthood. But I knew I couldn't take it up to their desk to ask for a photocopy because they would have to make it special. And I was afraid someone would make the connection. Why do you want this? And so I was afraid to talk to anyone about how to get that photo of that document. Well, our microfilm process we were using for our printing press at the time, we had the masters for the printing press were paper masters as opposed to metal ones. And we had this paper master material that Gerald got thinking about. He says, I bet if we laid that on the screen of the microfilm reader for a certain number of minutes, we could burn a master of that direct from their microfilm onto there. Well, how long do you think that would take? Well, so I don't know what all calculations Gerald did to try to figure out how long that would take. So we cut me several pieces of photographic material to fit. You know, when you look at a microfilm reader, you know, they come down and they have this base of, I don't know, what are they, 18-inch square or some. And so he had cut me microfilm, master material to the size I needed. And I had several of them and I rolled them up and had them in my purse. And so I went into the library, got the film, turned to the, found the thing I needed. And so I would just out of my purse, I would take one of these and lay it up there. And they had kind of a manila kind of a color to them anyway, so you wouldn't notice them laying there. And so I just lay there and read for, you know, okay, and roll it back up and put another one in, okay, we'll read for a while, you know, and went through several of these and went home, and we were able to develop a photo of that certificate. But we were pressing them on all this stuff before the Dialogue stuff was going on. Now, they did more research than us. They carried it further, but we were right at the beginning of all of that.
And basically this is showing that black people are receiving, select black people are receiving the priesthood, I think, up through 1890. At least there are living black people with the priesthood.
There's living people. So
Elijah Abel's son and grandson.
Right. And what had happened on them is as the years went by, the family started putting around that they were mixed Mexican, Spanish, and that accounted for the darkness in them. And so they passed into being white in Ogden. And so when this fellow, this friend of ours, was doing all this research, he went and talked to one of the descendants, which scared her to death. She said, please don't go public with this. Don't take it any further than the son and grandson, because you get below that, you're going to run into people that don't know they have black blood, and it's going to ruin their lives. Mm. They're going to lose a priesthood. They're going to be zip in the Mormon community. And, you know, this is going to be a horrible effect. So we never took it past those two.
Wow.
For that reason. We didn't want to cause living people grief, which it would have done. I mean, back then it would have just been horrible for someone to find out they were mixed black.
Recently I learned about William Clayton's journals.
Mm-hmm.
What's so disturbing? I've heard some people say that those are kind of disturbing. What's so disturbing about Clayton's journals?
Well,
do you know?
Yes. Some of it's polygamy, and some of it is has to do with Council of 50 and some political things that way that were going on in Nauvoo. But our interest was in the polygamy references. And so, that was another thing that got us in trouble. Different privileged scholars and BYU people had access to Clayton's diary, but not the rank and file. And word got around that some...
And William Clayton was Joseph's scribe for...
Yeah, his secretary for years. Faithful, trusted guy. Wrote everything down. And so this researcher, Ehat, was a student at BYU, and he had access to the diaries, and he had made some typed extracts and made a compilation of extracts from the diary that had some of this polygamy stuff. And he had it in his file cabinet in his office at BYU. And the office was also shared by a bishop's group or something. And so there was dual access to the room. Anyway, somebody that had access to the room knew about the Clayton material, felt it was unjust that they couldn't see the diary. Why should Ehat have access to something I can't? I'm a good member, and I can't see it. Why does he get to see it? So this guy goes in and takes his notes and photocopies them. And then they get spread all over BYU, and eventually a copy came to us. Well, his notes had his comments in between the extracts, so we blanked out all of his comments and just photographed the pages showing the extracts. And
were they disturbing?
Yeah.
Like, what kind of stuff?
That Joseph gets Clayton to go into polygamy. Clayton's wife's mother and sister are living with them. And so Clayton feels like, you know, God's told him, Joseph's told him he's got to live polygamy. So he goes to Joseph, okay, he wants to marry his wife's sister. I think her name's Margaret. And Joseph says, okay, yeah, you can marry her in polygamy. And then he comes back to Joseph and he's, in euphemistic ways, he says that, you know, Margaret's pregnant. And so what's going to happen when people figure this out? And what if charges are brought against me for getting her pregnant? And it isn't said this clearly, but that's what's going on. And Joseph says, oh, don't worry about it. I'll have to put you out of the church for a while, but later on I'll bring you right back in and set you right back up again.
Mm. Okay. Does he do it?
Well, evidently.
Okay.
And so that worked out. So then... Well, actually, there's a big story behind that. Margaret was in love with a guy that was on his mission, and he comes back, and he's devastated because they have to tell him. She tells him, she probably was showing in her pregnancy by then. Anyways, he becomes aware that she's pregnant with Joseph's child or Clayton's child, and everybody's unhappy. And so Clayton, and this is parts in his diary, he goes to Joseph. Nobody's happy. Can I release Margaret to go marry so-and-so? And Joseph tells him, no, once you're sealed by the priesthood, that's it. There's no divorce in this. Of course, later, everyone's going to get divorces. But this point, no, you're stuck. You got, that's it. Just tell her she got to buckle down because you can't get a divorce. And everyone's unhappy. And so poor Clayton, he's just lamenting that, that Margaret can't love him like she loves this other guy. And he feels bad about this. Because the other guy would take her even being pregnant.
Kind of like Joseph did with Mary.
Yeah. So that's in there. Then you have the story of Joseph and Emma go to visit one of the families in Nauvoo, and I don't remember the name of the family now, but when Joseph drops the Emma off, and he's going to the temple to check on things, and she's sitting there talking with the family, and this young girl, a teenager in the family, sitting across from her, and the young girl has a gold pocket watch. Well, evidently, Joseph must have given one to Eliza R. Snow. Emma sees that and immediately knows that he must have married this girl. So she's in a real snit about this. Joseph comes back to pick her up, and she's mad. And so Clayton tells how, because Joseph must have told him this whole story when he got home. He tells how all the way home, the two of them argued and fought over this polygamy deal. And then he says when they got home, now this is arguing, now they wouldn't have had too long a journey. I mean, it's just Nauvoo. I mean, it's not like it's the other side, you know, the world. But they argued all the way home. And when they get home, Clayton says, Joseph used, I think the word is severe, no, harsh. He used harsh measures to put an end to the argument. They already argued all the way home. So what were the harsh measures? I think he hit her. I think Emma could have been an abused wife. I don't know that, but that implies to me that he hit her to stop the argument.
Or used force in some way.
Used some kind of force to stop the argument. Very unhappy home life. The church always paints him and Emma as this beautiful couple. And yet you get reading the problems of how Emma's confronting him on polygamy. That's why it's so disturbing to people. Once they read the women's stories, it's one thing to see names on a sheet of paper. When you see these as real people and the turmoil this put Emma through of having, she's trying to help these young women in Nauvoo have a place to live. She's trying to be a mother to all these people and then feels betrayed. Joseph's in the, behind the closet door putting the moves on him. You take the two sisters he marries secretly, and then that doesn't work out. And finally, they have a big standoff in the front room where the two girls are brought in and Joseph's there with Emma. And he's sheepishly hanging his head and says, oh, sorry, girls, I guess you're going to have to move out. What? I mean, two young girls that married him because he's a prophet of God, and God said the angel's going to kill them if they don't live polygamy, and they submit to all this. And now Emma's throwing a snit. So, sorry, you'll have to move out. So they moved down the street, and we don't, you know, how did they feel about that? I don't know, but it looks like I'd have been pretty ticked. Now, they evidently stayed with the church, but polygamy has really become a major issue of late, more than it was in the past, because we know more about it, because the women are real. And when you read real stories of these women and what they all went through, then you realize that it was a horrible thing, and it was agonizing for these women. It changed their lives. They submitted to Joseph, and it cost them dearly, their reputations, their position. I mean, these young girls, they suddenly realized, I can't go out and date. I can't be part of the party scene anymore in Nauvoo. Just... what a devastating thing for them.
I'll refer our listeners to Lindsay Hanson Park's Feminist Mormon Housewives podcast, where they're doing a year of polygamy, where they're going over an episode for each of Joseph's wives. I hear it's a great episode. Also, Signature Books has recently, I think in the past year or two, released the William Clayton Diaries.
Yeah, and it would have these extracts I'm talking about.
And I hear it's really harrowing stuff.
Yeah. Also, the Todd Compton's book on the In Sacred Loneliness, the stories of the different women that were married to Joseph Smith. Todd writes it as a faithful Mormon in honoring these women for the sacrifice they made. But when you read the sacrifice they made, it doesn't make you feel warm fuzzies toward Joseph Smith.
But in all fairness, there are some wives that say it was wonderful and they loved it, right?
Well, yeah. Some women stay with husbands that beat them. I don't know that that's a selling point.
Okay. All right. Thomas Stewart Ferguson. Tell us that story.
Okay. Most people never heard of him. Back when we were, well, back in the late 50s, if you were trying to defend the Book of Mormon, and your Protestant friend had told you there's nothing to prove the Book of Mormon, it's all nonsense, and you go to the Deseret bookstore, what can I buy to help bolster my faith? You would have seen a book by Milton R. Hunter and Thomas W. Ferguson writing to prove the Book of Mormon, and this would have all this wonderful stories of artifacts in the Mayan culture that would prove the Book of Mormon. Back in the 50s,
baptismal fonts and Tenochtitlan and
yeah, these big
the white god that came down,
these big cement wheels circles that were supposed to prove they had cherries. I don't know what they think they were going to pull them, because you get four of those wheels and you aren't going anywhere with 20 mammoths, you know. Just anyways, but this was the book you would have gone to found arguments that, yes, there is something in the Mayans to tie to. Okay, so then...
So Ferguson was an archaeologist?
No, he was a lawyer. He started, what was it called, New World Archaeological Society.
I'll refer listeners to the Michael Coe podcast where we talk a little bit more about this. It's good stuff.
And, yeah, and so Ferguson was so enamored of the Book of Mormon, so sure they'd find the proof if they just kept digging in... Mesoamerica. He had got the church to kick in, I don't remember now what it was, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars into the kitty to support his investigation of trying to find support for the Book of Mormon.
Which shows that the brethren must have believed
it. At that time, they thought there was something to find, or at least some of them did. Whoever held the purse strings thought there was, and was helping to fund his studies. And so one day, I go to answer the door at the bookstore, and this man introduced himself as Tom Ferguson. Well, it didn't register who this was, because we had just been dealing with a woman in Las Vegas who had the last name of Ferguson, and I assumed this was one of her children coming to talk with me. Oh, yeah, come on in, sit down. And we started talking, and then... he starts talking about his visit with Apostle Brown and
Hubie Brown,
and he starts talking about problems with the Book of Mormon and all that. And it dawns on me, oh my word, this is Thomas Ferguson. Hold that thought. I got to go find Gerald. Just a minute. He'll never believe me if I don't get him in to hear this. So Gerald comes in, and Ferguson's telling us about how he's decided there's no evidence for the Book of Mormon.
Around what year is this? Like 60s, early 70s, late 70s, early
80s? What would it be, early 70s?
Okay. So it's next door in the house.
In our house next door. And he's telling us all this story of his talk with Brown and that he didn't believe the Book of Mormon anymore. And so we made the appeal to him that you owe it to the public to say something. If you can't come out and directly say the Book of Mormon is not true, there's no evidence for it, you at least ought to say something about some of the things you said in your book, that these no longer look to be viable options or something. You need to make something to kind of pull back from all these claims you made in your book. So we're trying to pitch that to him. And he finally says, well, I have a son that is in his teens and he's too fragile in his mental health. I'm afraid if I were to go public on this, that he would have a mental breakdown. He said, my son's too important to me for me to go public with all of this. I just can't do it. And that's the way it played out. So then later we found out about this paper he had written. The BYU guys, Sorensen, I don't remember who all was in the names at that time. Jakeman, I'm not sure. But anyway, several of the guys at BYU that were writing on archaeology stuff were doing some sort of switching of sharing of papers on Book of Mormon issues. And somehow this had involved Tom Ferguson as well. So Tom submitted his paper, only his was different to the rest of all the other guys. And his paper, he went through and showed all the problems with, they got the wrong metallurgy, they got the wrong animals, they got the wrong plants, and he would list them out. Here's all the references on metallurgy in the Book of Mormon where it would demand a very advanced metallurgy. Here's the plants they have. They got wheat and all this stuff that they couldn't have had here. They got horses, they got chariots, and all the different kind of animals the Book of Mormon mentions that couldn't be here. And he goes through all these things and says, it's all out of place. None of this could have been here. Everything we know about the Mayans, none of this could have existed. And so he had this paper. Well, we printed it up, and that got all kind of stuff brewing on Bruja on Book of Mormon issues. Then a lot of people didn't want to believe us that Ferguson had really said that. Ferguson, however, had privately written to several different people telling them that he didn't believe the Book of Mormon. Mormons, questioning Mormons that had written him for help. And he would write and tell them, oh, just stay part of the club. Yeah, it's not true, but, you know, I still sing in the choir. It's like, you know, fraternity or something, you know, you're part of the group. And just go along with the flow. But he didn't believe it. And one of the letters, he talks about the problems with the Book of Abraham. And I think that was the real final blow for him. When the Book of Abraham issue came out, he had taken the pictures of the facsimiles to linguists at Berkeley, I believe, because that's where he lived up in that area of California. And he took these to these professors that didn't know anything about Mormonism that he knew of and just showed them these facsimiles. Now, what are these about? Oh, well, yeah, this is Osiris, this is Isis, this is Anubis, you know, and they're giving the Egyptian rundown on the whole thing. And he realized, the critics are right. The Book of Abraham has no foundation. None of this stuff matches what Joseph Smith said it meant. So that was his final blow on Mormonism. And so we got involved in a bunch of that stuff. Ferguson died, and his son then collaborated with a guy at BYU to write a book that was supposed to save Ferguson's reputation and was supposed to be developed from the notes that Ferguson left behind to try to say that Ferguson still believed things. But I think it was Stan Larson, who used to be a church translator, got fired for writing stuff about Book of Mormon stuff, and he ended up at the University of Utah for years as the archivist there for manuscripts. But I think it was him that went to BYU and checked out the manuscripts of whatever the kid had used for writing the book. And he said, no, Ferguson didn't leave anything detailed enough that you could have built this book from it. The notes in the margins would say, need to revise or need to revisit or something. Well, that doesn't tell you what way he was going to revise it or revisit it. So anyways, once the issue came up, whether or not this was really true about Ferguson, we started collecting up different letters that showed that was the case. And then finally, Stan Larson took on the project, gathered up all the Ferguson stuff, all the letters he could, and then he came out with his book, what is it, Quest for the Book of Mormon, where he tells the Ferguson story and how he came to disbelieve it, the letters that he wrote to people, how he dealt with it, how he advised just going with the flow, staying with it, and don't upset your family. But none of it's true.
Mm. And didn't the Ferguson family disavow kind of deny that he lost his faith.
Yes, yes, that's why the son was trying to do that book.
So, kind of a sensitive issue. You probably read a little bit about this on the Mormon Stories blog or maybe on Facebook. There was a disagreement between Eugene England and Bruce R. McConkie.
Yeah.
Talk about that, and then we'll talk about the letters.
Okay, one day, so I'll have to tell you first. We have stuff that just happens. I mean, people give us documents, photos, or whatever, because they can't do anything with them because of their position, and they want someone to do something with it. So someone gave us a copy of the McConkie letter to Eugene England, where he admits that Brigham Young did teach Adam God, but England shouldn't be talking to anyone about this, and really castigates England that the brethren get to set doctrine, not the BYU guys, and got after him on several things. But to us, one of the important things in the letter was the verifying that Brigham did teach Adam God.
Wasn't that in Journal Discourses?
Well, who reads them?
Well, they were they were published.
Yes, but the church had denied it for years. That the church had, like when I first asked questions back in talking to my bishop in 59 and 60, that is Joseph Fielding Smith's answer, that it was just one sermon in the one volume of the Journal of Discourses, and maybe it was written down wrong, or it's a misunderstanding, or whatever. They'd always tried to smooth that all over. And so here's McConkie, an apostle, admitting, yeah, he did teach Brigham Young, he was wrong. Sometimes he said it right, sometimes he said it wrong. In this case, he's wrong. So it was kind of a big deal.
And maybe he wasn't too kind to Eugene England in the letter?
Oh, no, he was very castigating to him. We set doctrine, not you. So he really was calling him on the carpet on stuff. Anyways, a copy of the letter came to us, and we felt this was an important document in... here's an apostle admitting Adam God doctrine. He's admitting how they deal with sensitive areas, problems they don't agree with. They just hide it. You don't talk about it. You just talk about the good stuff, Brigham said. You don't talk about all this other stuff, see? So we thought this was an important letter to make public. And so we printed it up. Now, my understanding on this is that when McConkie sent the letter to England, that McConkie made copies of it that were sent to several associates of Eugene England. Now, I don't know who the associates were, but evidently several other people got copies of that letter. England was out of the country at the time, so he didn't get the letter when
Apparently
everyone...
Apparently you got it before England did.
Yeah, but that's because one of his buddies spread it around BYU. Back in those days, people used to joke about the Mormon underground. And there really was, like in the Mark Hoffman days, that's what he counted on giving advertisement to his business, was through the Mormon underground, put out, oh, did you know Mark's got a new document? And then he spread the word around. And it wasn't organized. It was just a bunch of people of like-minded people trying to put all the pieces together in Mormon history and not necessarily all agreeing with each other's position, but wanting to get all the documents they could. And so there was a trading going on. I have two Joseph Smith letters. What do you have? You know, oh, I got a Brigham Young letter. Okay, I'll swap you for that. You know, I mean, there was this trading going on in the Mormon underground for documents because the church was setting on everything. So maybe you get in the church historian's office and you get a photocopy of some rare thing that nobody else has seen. And so then you go to so-and-so, who he's got some other rare document he got to see. I'll trade you mine for yours. Well, mine's worth more than yours, so you got to give me two things, you know. So anyway, she had all this kind of stuff going on. That's how a copy of Eugene England's letter came to us. It was irrelevant to us who the letter was to. I mean, it was important that it went to a BYU professor, but that was not our focus. The focus was, this is an apostle making statements on doctrinal issues that should be known to everybody. Why is one person privy to this information and not everybody? Why can't the rest of us know that he concedes Brigham Young taught Adam God? So anyways, we printed the letter and it caused a big brouhaha and got the England family all mad. And I guess it caused them some embarrassment that we printed it. But that was a byproduct of it. That, you know, I had no intention of embarrassing anybody or causing them problems. I felt they're both public figures. This is like news, you know. So anyways, we printed it.
And, you know, a member of the family reached out to me and just said that from their perspective, the letter was obtained illegally. You had no right to share it. You didn't have permission to share it. And it caused, you know, Brother England a significant amount of pain and suffering. Eventually, he, I guess, is forced out of BYU or made to be so uncomfortable that he leaves.
But that's shooting the messenger. The problem's the church, not me. The church set up that scenario. They were the ones hiding history, telling England he can't be honest with people. We're in charge. You can only tell them what we tell you to tell them. So why aren't they mad at the church? As far as the distribution of the letter, then go get mad at the guy that first made the copy that spread it around. And maybe more than one did. I don't know how many of the guys made copies. But people all over BYU had copies before I did.
But isn't it a different thing to actually put it in print and publish it and sell it?
Yes, but if you're a whistleblower on the tobacco company, what are your concerns? If you get a letter where the tobacco chief admits it causes cancer, but it went to somebody that'll be embarrassed by the revelation? I mean, we felt this was a very important part of the whole story of Mormonism.
And if you had to say something to the England family now about the hurt they feel it caused, what would you say?
I'm real sorry that it did. We had no intention of hurting the family. I didn't really consider that it would have caused him. I really didn't think that went through. I guess I didn't think about it being that big of a thing for him. Because I thought the bigger embarrassment would be McConkie, that his letter was given out. In a sense, McConkie took it out of the private domain when he sent copies to other people.
That's fair.
So it wasn't just privilege between two people. McConkie gave copies to others. Once you do that, you have lost control of a document. Then anyone could have shared it.
And yeah, I guess if it hadn't been you, it could have been shared in some other way.
It would have eventually been somebody else, but it would have come out eventually when you have copies. I mean, I think most of the historians that we would both know that were around in that day probably got copies of it.
Yeah. But you regret that it's caused pain.
Yes, I'm very sorry that it caused the England family heartache on that. But they're shooting the messenger. They're not turning their anger to the right place.
Okay. Errington Papers.
Yeah.
Talk about that for a bit. Leonard Errington, who was he?
He was church historian, and he got done a dirty deal by the church. He wanted to do, what was it, this 26th volume of church history that was going to be what they should have done years before, and which evidently they're trying to do now. And England was just Errington was just ahead of his time. And so the church had got all these different scholars under contract for their volumes that they were going to do on church history, covering the whole spectrum from the beginning up to the time of the contract. And so then somebody realized this was going to be more truth-telling than they felt comfortable with. Somebody must have had a knee-jerk reaction to this and decided they got to pull the plug on it. And so then you've got people with manuscripts that are half-written or already signed on with the church or whatever, and you have all these people caught in the double bind of, what do I do now? I've got all this time and money invested in this research. Do I sign off and give it to them, even though they say they're going to deep six the book? I'll get paid, but that'll be the end of my research. Or do I pay back the advance royalty they gave me or whatever and publish it myself or seek another publisher? Some of them did go out and seek other publishers, and some of them did finally come out in books. Others of them had to give up their manuscripts. I don't know how they feel about it now, but it was a big mess. And Arrington got promoted to the BYU from the church historian's office, which was really a demotion, but they had to put it more to make it look like he was getting something better, but he really wasn't. He was taken out of historian's office. And my understanding that for a long time anyways, they didn't even have his picture up when they showed the wall that had all the historians. His picture wasn't up there. I don't know if they've changed that now, but for years it wasn't. You wouldn't even know any happened. So then he has all this research and papers that end up going to Utah State. And then the church must have realized that that would have a lot of stuff in it they wouldn't want necessarily public. So then they put the kibosh on that and told the university they're coming up and picking up some of the stuff. Well, they probably wanted it all, but they were able to come up and get several boxes. I was aware of the situation at the time. When did that happen? Do you remember the year of that?
No.
Might have been when Gerald had Alzheimer's. There was no way I could get away to go up because someone had called and told me, if you come up today, you can come up and you can see his papers before the church comes up and gets them. And I just couldn't get away. So missed out on that. But evidently they took back stuff that would have related to the Mountain Meadow Massacre research, that they weren't ready for that to go public in the raw form, at least, of whatever his notes were. A lot of that came out later, but at the time, the church was trying very hard to hold back on certain things, and we know that was at least one of the items that was what the church took back. Arrington, to me, is a very sad case of someone who was trying to do the right thing too early, and the church wasn't ready for someone to tell the whole story.
Did you ever meet him?
I think I met him at some history things or something, but I didn't know him.
The church has sued you guys, right?
The Mormon Church sued us in 1999, 2000 time frame. We had so many people coming to us asking how they'd get their name off the rolls. People would tell their bishop, I want to leave the church. And the bishop would essentially say, well, you didn't do it right. And they'd say, well, how do I do it right? Well, you know, you got to write a letter and la, la, la. And the people get frustrated because they'd always keep getting this thing of, we'll let you know, or we're going to do it, but they wouldn't, or they wouldn't tell them just how to do it. If you send in a form letter, they wouldn't accept it. They'd send it back. It's got to be your personal letter. And people said, how are we supposed to know what the rules are? We want our name off. They keep getting more teachers out, the fast offering people, people contacting their kids, all kind of stuff still going on. I want to separate myself from the church. How do I do this? And I got so tired of telling people about the church handbook, what it says. People want to know, well, if I get a divorce, what will this mean for my temple ceiling? If I leave the church, how will that affect all of that? What if my husband then wants to marry some other woman and have the kids sealed to her? Is my ceiling still intact? And so I'm telling people all the time, well, this is what the church handbook says. This is what it says. And this, you know, so I finally thought, well, the easiest thing would be to just print those pages of the church handbook, which members didn't have access to. Now, people will say to me, oh, well, they have access. It's in the bishop's office. And I says, yeah, how many members know it's there? And how many would be given access to it? People didn't know to ask. That's why they come to me. They didn't know there was anything like a handbook that gave instructions. So we put up parts of the church handbook pages that told about how to take your name off, who you contact, all that kind of stuff, and ramifications on ceilings and stuff that way. And so one day I'm here in the bookstore and two guys come in and they were in this, I don't know, looked like a Lincoln Continental or something, real spiffy black car. And they come in and they're obviously lawyers. They got that black suit and that long coat. There's just a lawyer look about this. You know, these two guys come in. And I said, hi. And they said something about, do you know why we're here? And I said, no. And said, well, we're here to serve papers on you. And the guy gets out his inside of his coat and hands me this thing that says, if we don't have those pages off our web page by 1 o'clock, and this is like 11 o'clock that they come in, if you don't have those off of the web page by 1 o'clock, we're going to sue you for copyright infringement for putting up those pages on the website. I think they were counting on us not having somebody on site to handle our web page. But we did. And I went in the other room and said, Mark, we got to take that down. Church is threatening to sue us. So he had it down, probably had it down by 12. Didn't matter. At 5 o'clock, they filed, or whatever, just before five, they filed on the lawsuit immediately. I mean, there was no niceness about this at all. They weren't giving us any chance. Although they came in and said, you know, in this, that if we have it down by one, that if we don't have it down by one, they'll sue us. They intended to sue us no matter what, because we had it down and they still went ahead with it. So the copyright thing got to be a real hairy deal. One of the problems was the judge we had did not understand internet. And in that time, there was very little internet law. And so a lot of things weren't understood of what can you do on the internet that you couldn't do other places, or, you know, property rights and all that kind of stuff. So a lot of confusion on internet law. Our argument was going to be that the church handbook has a history of 100 years of publication of various editions that gradually grew more and more complicated through the years. So what part of that are we going to say was covered by copyright? Because there was parts of it done before copyright. Then they added to it, and each time they'd add to it, they'd do another copyright. Okay, so the whole question would be, does your current copyright only protect you on a certain percent of this text? And would the rest be in public domain because it was done too early? So anyways, we felt that we could argue that they didn't have grounds for a copyright suit on it, and that it was fair use, and we were showing it. We weren't making money on it. We weren't selling it. It was just on our web page to give information to help people take their name off the roll. And boy, they were out for blood. I think they really thought they had a chance to bankrupt us. We hadn't really got very far into depositions or anything yet, but we took that right down, and we put up a thing on the website about how we were being sued and stuff, and people sent us letters. So this one guy sends a letter that he says, well, this is ridiculous, since there's another site out there that has the whole church handbook on it, and they aren't suing them. Okay, so we put this guy's letter up in our, I don't remember if it's our newsletter or just directly on the site, where he says that it's in this other website. It wasn't a hot link. You would have had to copy and paste the web address to have gone to it. Well, when we put that letter in, the Mormon lawyers hauled us back into court that we were defying the judge's order through an end run around that we couldn't publish the document anymore until this was resolved. Well, we weren't distributing it anymore. We had this letter that had mentioned that this isn't fair because this other site has the whole thing. And so the judge was put this ruling out that we were in contempt of court for putting up this website. Well, the Salt Lake Tribune and the New York Times had both reported on the case, I mean, we were big news in internet law, not just Mormon, internet law, because there were so few cases on internet stuff. Well, when the Salt Lake Tribune and the New York Times ran their articles, they mentioned this other site. Theirs was a hot link. If you went to their paper and read it online, it was a hot link. You just pressed on that and you could go to this guy's site that had the whole handbook. And so it was really kind of crazy. So what's the point of coming after me for just typing the address that's not a hot link? Well, the judge can't understand the fine point of this because she doesn't understand internet and hot links and not links and cut and paste and all that kind of stuff. And so she rules against us that we were contributing to copyright violation by putting up the address to the website. What this would have done, if they'd have gone forward with the trial, what this would have done was ruined the internet. Because it would have meant you could not refer anyone to any website for fear that it, if it had copyright infringement, you could be held just as equally responsible for copyright infringement. You see how this would cripple things. We appealed it to the 10th Circuit Court in Denver that this is crazy. You can't have a law that says you can't put up a link in case it has, that you're going to make me responsible for copyright material on someone else's site. So we get it over the Denver Appeal Court. And of course, the courts are all backed up. 10th Circuit's way backed up. So they want to try to work through everything they can without going to actual before the judges. So court arbitrator or whatever comes to talk and talks to our lawyer about, is there some way we can reach an agreement between the parties on this so it doesn't have to go before the judges? So my lawyer calls me and says, well, so what do you think? Would you be willing to negotiate? And in 2000, this is when Gerald was starting in more noticeably into his Alzheimer's. I knew that a lawsuit like this would take at least 5 to 7 years to go through the courts. I knew those were the years, the only good years I would have left with Gerald. And I thought, I can't do that to Gerald. And I said, well, yeah, if there's some way to negotiate. I said, but there's certain conditions. I will not admit to wrongdoing, and I won't pay them any money. Now, if you can negotiate something outside of that, then let's talk. So the church came back and said, through their lawyer, as of whatever day we settle this, I have to destroy all copies of the handbook that I have in my possession. Well, I had editions going way back, the different ones. And I talked to my lawyer about this. And he says, you just give away those copies. You keep one copy. The day you sign it, you destroy that copy. And you cleared that. He says, there's nothing in it that says you can't own a copy tomorrow. So
that's kind of sneaky.
Yeah, go get them all tomorrow. So, but today you're going to have to destroy them. Whatever ones you got on at that time, wherever in your building, on your computer, everything has to be deleted today. Do whatever you want tomorrow. Oh, okay, I can live with that. And then it stipulated we could not quote more than 50 words out of the handbook in any one article. Well, I thought that's stupid. I could print the whole thing, 50 words at a time, as a running thing in different articles. Okay, so I'm trying to think through. Oh, what are the chances I'd need 50 words out of handbook again? And I thought, well, in light of a lawsuit, probably pretty small. I can work around that. So I thought, okay, I'll give them the 50 words. And there were, you know, little stupid things like this in the stipulation. But so I signed off of it. The law. Oh, the one thing we negotiated, besides not guilty, not paying him money, the third one was that the judge would vacate her order on the linkage ruling that she made. And so she vacated her ruling, although lawyers still use it in arguments. And the whole thing went away. Then it all just resolved. But I think the church thought they had a chance to once and for all get rid of the Tanners. They didn't count on the problem of the internet.
Yeah, in more ways than one.
Yeah.
Were you guys involved in the Godmakers?
I was interviewed for the Godmakers. I had nothing to do with the production or the outline, the story, how it was done. I had no editing voice. I was just interviewed for it. I didn't know ahead of time what the storyline was going to be. I didn't, you know more than anybody else that got interviewed in it.
Did you like it once you saw it?
No, Gerald and I were both upset with the tone. And we felt that there were some exaggerations in it that we felt were just... well, they exaggerated some people's credentials, and this has been brought out before. Like one minister, they speak of him as being an archaeologist and expert on Mayan stuff or whatever. No, he's a minister. He's read up on that stuff. So have I, but I would hardly consider myself an expert on Mayan just because I've read a number of books on it. And, you know, so it was overstating people's credentials. But then one of the things that bothered me was... and it's a very touching story. They interview this father of a son that commits suicide, and they lay it all to the church's lap that the son committed suicide. Well, in some ways it was, but it was a situation that could have played out in any church. Evidently the son had, as I understand it, it wasn't explained in the film, but my understanding is the son had a very severe problem with masturbation. And the church had him feeling so guilty and so defeated, something he couldn't control and he didn't know what to do and he was always sinning and just going deeper and deeper in a hole, that's why he finally committed suicide. Well, so the father's putting it to the church, their pressure on perfectionism and all is what led the kid to suicide. Well, yes, that's true, but it's also... unfortunately, something that could have happened in many other settings. So I was a little troubled by that. It seemed to single out them as the guilty of something that could just as easily happen in their next door neighbor's house. In a film that was to show you what's wrong with Mormonism, it was the way it was handled.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories Podcast. To check out the video version of this episode, go to youtube.com/Mormon Stories. To continue the conversation or to keep these podcasts alive through a financial contribution, please check us out at mormonstories.org, and thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. 'Tis better far for us to strive our useless cares to drive, do this and joy, your hearts will swell.